studio somewhere far, far away.
Experience. Thank you very much, and welcome to the summer season of the Merry White House Experience. My name is David Baddiel. I am a bit low at the moment, as I haven't really got over my grandfather's death. He died 2 days ago on the occasion of his 92nd birthday, which was a great shame, as we were only halfway through giving him the bumps. However, this is Punt and Dennis.
Tonight, we examine the question which is on the lips of the nation. All across the land, the same topic is being discussed. Tonight, we ask, why are the England cricket team so crap? So crap, in fact, that from now on they're changing their name to South Africa.
Cricket is, of course, part of the traditional British summer. The sound of leather against willow, or in England's case, the sound of willow against air. On the face of it, cricket is a simple enough sport. All you have to do is hit a ball around a field and run up and down. Sadly, this degree of sophistication is proving too much for a team who have achieved the most embarrassing test results since Ben Johnson's.
So, what is the cause of England's cricketing demise? Apart, obviously, from being crap. First of all, let's eavesdrop on the team dressing rooms just before the start of the last test match. Through a hidden microphone, we hear inside the Australian dressing room.
OK, boys, we're going out there to win. We're going out there to play hard. Are we ready?
Yeah! Australia, 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 let's go!
Meanwhile, in the England dressing room...
Just run through it again, Kenny. Right, they throw the ball at me.
No. They bowl the ball. They bowl the ball.
You've lost me. Oh. You've lost me, sorry.
We're on in 5 minutes.
The pad doesn't go there. It goes on your leg.
Can I bowl underarm?
Don't let him bowl. He does daisy cutters.
Does my hair look okay?
It's fine, Ian. It's fine.
In the commentary box, the job of the pundits is to resist the knee-jerk reaction of the press and public and provide a more thoughtful and considered analysis.
And what a completely crap performance we are seeing from England. Well, let's run through the card. Australia in their first innings scored 214 off the first over and then went on to make 796 for three and then declared that England were crap at bowling. Then the England side came into bat. The opening pair, Gooch and Curtis, were both crap. Robinson came in, looked rather promising, but was crap. Robin Smith scored a fine 147 in the first innings, and then in the second innings, he was crap. David Gower came in, obviously looking for a captain's innings to rally his side. He took a middle stump guard, looked fiercely determined, and was crap. Both of them, well, he was just bollocks. Well, by this time, England were on a fine 19 for 5. Australia then brought on two new bowlers, Rolf Harris and a small koala bear called Timmy. Both of these wreaked havoc on the England batsmen.
And so it went on. Two England players went for a duck, another was bowled out by a duck, and the rest just ran away in sheer embarrassment. That evening, even the newsreaders couldn't disguise their own feelings.
And finally tonight, sport. And in the fourth test, England were totally crap. And it's been announced tonight that from now on, MCC will stand for Massively Crap Cricketers.
I'd like to play a song now. It's called You'll Always Find Me in the Kitchen at an Acid House Party.
Well, Johnny was a kid who grew up living on the edge of the Surrey border. He thought himself the rebel of the TSB branch office because he told a rather snidey joke 2 years ago. And every T-shirt Johnny got it first. He had the Batman and the Frankie Goes to Hollywood. He even had the smiley yellow face, one that he got from Marks and Spencer. Well, Susie was a wild child. All around her desk she'd put up black and white art postcards of men's bottoms. Flame to Johnny's moth, and through the thin cloth of his Birkin shirt, she saw that smiling yellow. She said, There's a party across the county line, it's only 15 quid. And in his heart of hearts he knew that 15 quid was even more than he spent seeing Christy Berg at Wembley. But he couldn't say no. Well, in the car they didn't talk, cos he said he worshipped Mickey Rourke, and she thought Mickey Rourke was Mickey Rooney. Girl, did you bring some booze? She said, perhaps we should drop in at Victoria Wine and get a bottle of Hirondelle, because I like that. And when she went to telephone, he popped to get a family tin of Quality Street, just as a little thank you for the couple whose aircraft hangar they were going to. And when they got there, she went off to dance, and he went off to find somewhere where he could put their coat. He thought he'd break the ice by telling her how he once met Andy Crane on Birmingham New Street Station. Then someone said, the pigs are here. How the hell did they find out? And Johnny said, oh, I invited my friend PC Jepson. And the police called out the army, but the army just turned up, pissed on one another, and then went away again. And as the party got higher and higher, Johnny looked for Susie, offering round some twiglets, which he bought himself. And finally he told her. She said, do you know what ecstasy is? And he said, well, I once met Andy Crane on Birmingham Station. And when the brand new dawn revealed 500 bodies sprawled across the floor, there was one stepping in between, offering dry toast around and saying, everyone, listen, we really ought to hoover up. Because he's the kind of guy who buys the T-shirts and then hides in the kitchen at an acid house party.
As you must all know, the government is presently trying to privatise water and sewage. And as everyone who's recently turned on their taps must know, this seems to involve amalgamating the two. Amongst the things to turn up in tap water lately are worms, insect larvae, and most recently of all, prawns. And actually, in my tap water, I even found some Thousand Island dressing and a side salad.
The government advertising campaign has recently shifted its emphasis from water to sewage as it moves up the ladder of hygiene. But the advertising of sewage does present certain problems, strangely enough.
Oh, hello. Look, this is terribly embarrassing, but I'm having a dinner party and I seem to have run out of sewage.
Ooh. Well, all I've got is this jar of gold blend.
That will do nicely.
It doesn't quite work. Here is another failed attempt.
Yeah, in England, nehmen Sie es poo-poo.
The government hopes to operate the privatisation along the same lines as British Telecom. So following the share issue, customers can expect toilets shaped like Mickey Mouse, car toilets, some of which have already been marketed in the form of the Skoda, and the elaborate and detailed itemising of domestic bills.
Let me see now. Darling, did you do three dumps on the 3rd of May?
No, darling, just the two.
Well, they've overcharged us again. And I didn't have a curry on the 5th of June.
It's the kids again. They've been using it at peak time, just after breakfast.
Well, that's it. We're just going to have to get a logbook.
One last thing you may have noticed about the privatisation is that it only includes the water and sewage businesses of England and Wales. Well, obviously, there's no need for a publicity campaign in Northern Ireland, as sewage already has a fashionable image there, thanks to the pioneering work of interior designer Bobby Sands.
And finally, we would like to echo the authorities in suggesting that you do boil your water. Not so much to get rid of all the microbes, as because you do end up with a very hearty casserole.
And welcome to the Donna MacPhail experience. When I was on holiday in Spain recently, I got talking to some Spanish policemen and they were going on and on about how much they hated the English. And I said to them, I said, listen, not every English person is a sexually repressed lager-drinking psychopath who gets their kicks out of pushing their bare buttocks up against shop windows, you know? It's just that, well, I'm on holiday and I was just trying to have a laugh. But I think it's true what they say. When you're abroad, you can't help but see Britain in a different light, especially if you're in another EEC country, because, let's face it, we're not exactly the most popular member of the European community, are we? It's like they haven't adopted any of our traditions the way we have theirs. You can't move in London these days for pavement cafes. Now, that's okay in Paris, because they've got bloody wide pavements. Over here, it's ridiculous. We haven't got the space. What with the tables and the chairs and the homeless people, there's hardly any room left for the pedestrians. Let alone the dog turds. And all the continental food you can get over here. You can eat anything you want. You can eat Italian, Greek, Spanish, French. You can even go Swedish if you don't mind eating in a furniture shop. I'm not a very sophisticated eater, let's face it. My idea of a delicacy is something you boil in a bag. Like tea. And I could never travel to exotic places because of the food and the insects. And the fact that in some places they appear to be the same thing. And in my opinion, vegetarian food is the worst. I mean, I have actually eaten a nice vegetarian meal in my time. Lemon meringue pie. And I'm not about to take the piss out of vegetarians here because some of my best friends are vegetables, actually, to be honest. I lived with a couple of veggies once, and they were very right on. They used what's called a perfectly natural herbal toothpaste. So I read the packet of toothpaste, and it said, containing no sweeteners, no artificial flavourings, no colourants, no preservatives, no foam booster, no fluoride, no bloody toothpaste, basically. Just herbs. And I thought, I shouldn't ask this question because I know it's going to be a stupid answer, but I couldn't resist. I asked the man of the house, I said, well, why do you use this stuff? And he turned to me and he said, actually, he didn't do it. I just did that. Sorry about that. It's all right, I don't have to eat later now. No, he said, look, Donna, in that really annoying way vegetarians have, sort of cross between condescension and constipation. He said, look, Donna, it's like because, right, we preserve the right of plaque to grow unhindered in its natural environment, okay?
The Mary Whitehouse Experience.
What we'd like to talk about now is the growing reactionary trend towards sexuality in popular culture, reflected most acutely in the modern-day glamorization of monogamy in popular music. Yeah, we were actually trying to make an intellectual point there, but unfortunately the switchboard is now jammed with callers thinking we're playing Bits and Pieces. Hello? No, it wasn't all the same song. Now, the myth is that our present sexual climate has been created by AIDS. But in fact, AIDS has just been used as a way of regulating sexuality. I mean, if they discovered a cure for AIDS tomorrow, would they put out this sort of advert?
There is now a disease which is affecting us all. The horn. It can affect you at any time. High-risk areas include the library, the laundrette, and even your auntie's spare bedroom. It's no good flicking through that shelf of Pulp Fiction. There isn't a horny bit in the whole of Georgette's hair. So, always use a condom. Morning, noon, and night. As well as any other form of contraception you can get your hands on. And don't forget, the more partners you have, the more likely you are to win a Community Action Trust reward. The horn. Don't die of abstinence. And now, on Children's BBC, it's time for Neighbours. Today, Harold insists on lentil pot roast and Charlene shags bouncer.
In a similar context, the overwhelming trend towards moralism in soap operas would also be reversed.
Ian, Ian.
What is it, Cindy?
The baby's not yours. I slept with Wixie.
Oh, that's all right. So did I.
The new monogamous 007 would be thrown out in favour of a return to the old-style Bond.
day, 007. Now, here are some of your new gadgets. Oh, do pay attention, 007. Do pay attention. Now, strap yourself into the seat here. Press this concealed button on the left, and then the whole thing just takes off.
I see. And what's that called?
A Ronco stair lift. Some way of getting you up to bed. Now, here's the plan. Stand on this metal platform. When the guard presses the button, it will rise up about 3 inches. Then wheel yourself off into the minibus and we'll all have a nice day out in Sidcup.
But as long as AIDS is being used as a sexual corrective, monogamy remains rife.
Hello, darling. Just to say, I'm picking up the kids from school, but I've put the hot pot in the oven, so we should be able to all sit down for a nice family meal about 8 o'clock. Love you. Bye.
Whoa, I love those 0898 numbers.
Now, you will all know by now about the local government bill that forbids the promotion of homosexuality, or as it has been called, Clause 28. But I don't know how many of you are aware of Clause 29, the section that forbids the promotion of Charlton Athletic. This part of the bill actually went through the legislature in 1899 when Charlton Athletic all wore baggy shorts, peaked caps and had bushy moustaches, which is why it's often confused with Clause 28. But what I'd like to do now is actually see if we can possibly promote a bit of homosexuality in our audience tonight. Okay, so here we go. Homosexuality is really great.
All right, hold it right there. I'm from the Government Heterosexuality Enforcement Squad. I'm going to investigate the full scale of the damage. Right, you. What football match were you at last week?
I was not at football.
You poof! You bloody poof! Right. One. Poof. Right, you. How many pints of lager did you have last night? Or was it shandy?
I just had a shandy.
Proof positive, mate, that if you promote homosexuality, people turn into homosexuals.
But all I said was homosexuality is really great.
What?
Homosexuality is really great.
What's happening to my wrist? It's going all sort of limp. And my other arm is forming the gun on my hip, forming the shape of a teapot. And tell me why. Oh, no. Tell me why. In the Navy.
There you are. So there you are, kids. Watch Russell Grant at your peril. But as the tide of reaction and monogamy rises, there remains one woman who, through the tabloids, has remained an oasis of sexual freedom. One woman, at least, who always seems to have a constant trail of men through her bedroom.
My husband and I... do it. We do. I know you think we don't, but we do. Sometimes, when I appear on the palace balcony, I am, in fact, naked from the waist down. As indeed I am now. Yours sincerely, name withheld.
It's the Mary Whitehouse Experience.
And now, the Justice Experience. Today's the day on which we put the record straight. The day on which we state unreservedly that Ken Dodd is innocent. The facts. Ken Dodd was paid for many of his appearances cash in hand. Conclusion? Ken Dodd is innocent. Facts. Much of this money was hidden in Dodd's home, under mattresses or in the loft. Conclusion? Ken Dodd is innocent. Fact. Mr. Dodd confessed to being so naive with money that he regularly made trips to offshore tax havens to deposit large amounts of cash. The inescapable conclusion. Ken Dodd is innocent. Mr. Dodd's accountant subsequently served a prison sentence. Conclusion, Ken Dodd is innocent. If you would like to help the Ken Dodd is innocent fighting fund, please send your donations, cash only, to... 761, the Cayman Islands, outside British territorial waters. And remember, Ken Dodd is innocent.
I actually hate Prince Edward more than anybody else on earth, in fact. He's the most tedious man in the country. In fact, if Prince Edward was a shop, he'd be Halfords. I've actually now put Prince Edward's name on my kidney donor card. So that in the event of me being in an accident, he has to have his liver and kidneys removed. Prince Edward is also the only member of the royal family in 2,000 years to have been unemployed. He's actually in a family that are allowed to make up jobs for people, and yet they couldn't find one for him. And what I resent most of all is being told that I have to like the Queen Mother. And this is a woman, the only thing she has ever achieved is being old. Well done, Mom. Your hair's gone grey. Congratulations. I'll tell you who's going to be first against the wall in my revolution. If there's ever a revolution, the first against the wall are going to be those bloody corgis, right? And I've already worked out a way to kill the corgis, right? What you do is you put them in a sack with loads of very, very heavy stones, right? And then you take it down to the canal, okay? But you don't throw it in. You just leave it on the side so they starve to death. I don't actually hate dogs, but I do hate people who like dogs. What annoys me most of all is if you're driving down the motorway, and this really does annoy me, it's going to cause a major accident one day, is when you see in the back window of the car in front, caution, show dogs in transit. As if you're going to say, oh, I was going to deliberately crash into that car, but now I think I'll be a little more cautious. I'm not actually against the royal family. I just don't think it should be the one that we've got at the moment. I think they should give other people a chance. They could advertise, couldn't they? Wanted for country of rapidly diminishing importance. Queen. £1 million per annum plus free extra birthday. I'd like to be a member of the royal family. I'd like to be a prince. If I was a prince, I'd get involved in a lot of decreeing. A royal decree today announced that every day at 10 o'clock, Giles Brandreth should have to stand outside the Houses of Parliament and eat a piece of dog shit. But the best thing about if I was a prince would be that would mean that my mum would be queen, which would be absolutely brilliant. Because first of all, my mum hates being called by her first name, so she'd have to be Queen Mrs. Hancock. And also, my mum really hates people coming round. She hates people coming to the house. So you'd get things like, President Kwanda of Nigeria today was a guest of Queen Mrs. Hancock at the Burnie in Stoke-on-Trent. The president had the steak and strawberry special and a cherry B. And also the thing about my mum being queen is they'd have to find a photo of her to put on the £5 notes. And we've only got one photo of my mum at home, and that's of her coming off the water slide at Alton Towers. So that'd be really brilliant.
This. I'm going to get on with the punchline competition now, the punchline experience. Now, for those of you who don't know, what's happened is, before the show, the studio audience were asked to come up with a punchline to the following question. What did Batman say to Robin when he had to explain to the Boy Wonder why he wouldn't be in the new film? And I've got the answers all here on bits of paper, and the best one will win a prize, a night out in Glasgow with Mo Johnston's father. So here we go. What did Batman say to Robin when he had to explain to the Boy Wonder why he wouldn't be in the new film? Holy smoke, wrong hood. Yeah. Because you wouldn't let me borrow your copy of Fly Fishing by J.R. Hartley. If only comedians in the old days knew that's all you had to say to get a round of applause. Fly Fishing by J.R. Hartley. What did Batman say to Robin? Blah, blah, blah. I'm afraid they couldn't find any stretch tights big enough to fit over your huge ass. What did Batman say to Robin when he had to explain to the Boy Wonder why he wouldn't be in the new film? Robin, you're not in the new film. We always get this person in. They haven't really understood the idea of comedy. I think they're a scriptwriter for Something for the Weekend. This is quite a clever one. He hasn't written anything, and then he's written Lord Lucan at the bottom. Sorry, Dick, you're over 21 now. It's no fun anymore.
I'll give that one carries. That's from Joe. You win the night out with Mo Johnson's father. Big hand for Joe, ladies and gentlemen.
The Mary Whitehouse Experience.
And now the Dungeons and Dragons Experience is proud to bring you an interactive audience participation fantasy adventure. Dare you enter the catacombs of death and face the fearsome smeg beast of Throck? Of course you don't. That's why you have to sit around playing fantasy games with other sad bastards taking time off from train spotting.
Anyway, in this story, you choose the way we go. We can go anywhere you want, provided it's in the script and we've got the sound effects ready. So, the Dragon Sword of Trollsbane, part the first.
Long, long ago, in a distant time.
It's all right, this isn't a lager advert. Just get on with it in your normal voice, please.
Long, long ago, in a distant time, there lived
a dragon beast of doom.
In the land of Gonad.
So, far away and long ago, we find ourselves in a mysterious land. A landscape of mountains and rivers, of goblins and serpents. A land such as mortals can see only on the cover of crap old Yes albums.
And in the dale by the running brook that flows from the great lake of Grondar, we find our hero. A young troll by the name of...
Now, this is the first point at which you can influence the story and enter a world of fantasy and imagination. What is your name?
Jim.
Jim, that'll do. Right. Could you come up on the stage, please? Right, big hand for Jim the Troll, please.
Right, don't worry. David, start then.
Wait, young Jim, for I have a task for you to perform. A task far greater than any you have yet attempted. To proceed, you must guess what that task is. Just have a go, Jim. Don't look at the script.
Find the nearest tavern.
Find the nearest tavern. What a crap task. I can't see that among the seven tasks of Hercules. One, moving a mountain. Two, swimming the Caspian Sea. Three, finding the nearest tavern. No, Jim. No, Jim. You look like a troll as well. Sorry. For you must know that the mighty rune sword of Wotan has been stolen.
So, were you in the Wotan area on Thursday evening? Did you see a gang of small goblins who made their getaway in a P-Reg Ford Granada? If you did, tell me where you got the stuff, because I'd like to try it as well. Probably off Jim, I think, but...
Now, Jim... You must set out on your quest armed only with three weapons. A dagger, a shield, and one other item to take on this most perilous of journeys. What item do you choose?
An axe.
An axe.
That's too sensible. No laughs.
You must choose a watering can or something like that. An axe. How boring. So, armed with his shield, his dagger, and his watering can... Jim sets out. His first obstacle is to pick his way through the labyrinth of doom. Now, there are three possible doors. A square door, a round door, and an arched door. Only one of these doors will take you into the labyrinth. The others spell certain doom. One leads to a free fortnight on the Costa del Sol with no typhoid inoculations. The third door lurks a fearsome carnivorous beast with the body of a Tyrannosaurus and a visage so hideous that mortal man cannot encounter it and live. Which door are you going to choose?
Go for the arch window.
Oh, no.
Jim's chosen the third door.
You've chosen the third door.
Hello and welcome to Going Live.
Well, I'm afraid that Jim didn't last very long, because in fact, on your very first hurdle, you managed to get yourself eaten alive by Philip Schofield. Which is pretty crap by any standards. There was actually a secret underground passage out, but obviously they were on strike today. So,
Well, that's this week's game come to a close because Jim the Troll is dead, so we'll have to return next week with a new adventure, not featuring Jim, but possibly featuring someone else from the audience. Thank you very much indeed, and good night.
You've been listening to The Merry White House Experience. It was written and performed by David Baddiel, Rob Newman, Steve Punt, Hugh Dennis, Nick Hancock, Donna McPhail and Tim Firth. The production assistant was Viv Drew, the sound was by John Whitehall, and the producer was Harry Thompson.